Adventures. This is Babe Russell, KAZU-FM in Pacific Grove, California, April 16th, 1984. If I sound a little bit heated up and angry at the news, I am, and I guess it's coming down pretty heavy, and we'll do the best we can to take it and describe it just as it is without getting too emotional. But as I said earlier, before World Watchers started, for the others, get a pencil and make a note maybe of some of the names. I'm going to go pretty fast tonight, but there's some things you may want to remember. And if it goes too fast, you can always send a self-addressed stamped envelope to me, Carmel, Box 22511. That's a P.O. Box, and the zip is 93922. And I'll send you a sheet or a series of sheets on past broadcasts with a bibliography. I do that every week, filling those out. Now to begin with what happened just a year ago tonight. This was broadcast number 541, April 18th, 1983. I was talking, that was the date of a year ago today. I was talking about Fritz Kramer versus Fritz Kramer, and that was when I got the photograph from the Pentagon through our congressman here, Leon Panetta, a picture of Fritz Kramer, the mentor of Henry Kissinger and Alexander Haig, and it finally arrived, this glossy, and then I have the pictures of Hitler's Fritz Kramer, and I put the two of them side by side, one in the docket at Dachau, and the 45 years old in 1946, a prisoner, and the Fritz Kramer that was given an award in the Pentagon in 1970, then 69 years old, and I wrote to him in Washington, D.C. at his office, the Institute on Strategic Trade, which he shares with Lieutenant General Daniel Graham of High Frontier Space Station, laser weapons, and so forth, with a history that interlocks to future broadcasts of Edwin Meese and John Reese and Edward Teller and Western Goals. There are a lot of interlocking names tonight that I'm not going to put on the diagram like I do sometimes with the sheets, but I will diagram and chart them out in about 4 weeks. So in the meantime, just listen to the names and watch it flow. I wrote to this Mr. Fritz Kramer and sent the two pictures and said, "Is this you?" That was my great courageous gesture. He never answered it, and it never came back. He didn't say, "Dear Mrs. Russell, I appreciate your concern because we share the same name, but I would be horrified if you thought that I was sitting in that docket as a war criminal and then running your Pentagon ever since. Heaven forgive me," but I never got an answer. No answer doesn't mean he's not the same person, but he didn't answer the letter. And I went into things about the John Kennedy assassination from Dachau, linking the people at Dachau trial who released Fritz Kramer and Mr. Dietrich and Otto Skorzeny, who walked away, to the Dallas assassination of John Kennedy. And I went into Robert Morris and Charles Willoughby, and I also put on that, there were two sheets that went with that broadcast. I listed all the people that were in the 26 volumes of the Warren Commission hearings that Sylvia Marr indexed, and the witnesses and the exhibits, and left out the most important people that tied to the Dallas conspiracy that went back to Nazi Germany, to the Young Americans for Freedom, the World Anti-Communist League, and so forth, and have a list, a very important list. If you don't have it, you might want to send for that. And a lot of that was in the article I did on the anniversary of John Kennedy's death in Rebel, November 22nd, 1983. This I had on the air in April and detailed some of the people that went from Nazi Germany to the Philippines and to the Pentagon that were involved in killing John Kennedy. Now, I have one quick request for you tonight. Sometimes I'm not able to get an article that I want. I was told on the telephone about a Mr. Crook, C-R-O-O-K, who was murdered. He was cut up in four more pieces down in Atlanta, Georgia, in DeKalb County. He was the attorney for Wayne Williams, and he was killed on the 27th of March. And I'm very interested in that because the very same time that he died was when the stories were breaking out about Mrs. Meese and the money that she had in that medical lab in Buffalo where they manufactured interferon for cancer. And Dick Gregory was concerned about murders in Atlanta, Georgia, and using these black children for interferon for experiments. And the very week that that news broke about Mrs. Meese and the biotech subsidiary of Dr. Earl Bryan, that story broke. So if you find any newspapers, I take my 10 a day, plus others I get clippings from. I have not seen the name C-R-O-O-K. He's an attorney for the Civil Liberties Union in Atlanta, and he was murdered on the 20—this was March 27th. So if you find it, send it to me. Now, there was one marvelous article in the newspaper today. I'm not going to detail it tonight, but I don't want to pass it up for anything. Secret Finances, a Reagan Unit. This has to do with a foundation, of course, another foundation, the Presidential Transition Foundation for 1980 to 1981, that the Internal Revenue has a record. They had $250,000 in it. Then they had another $727,000. And of the $250,000, $50,000 was given as a loan to this institute. And they won't tell who put the money up. That's a big secret, who put the money. So is it the San Diego Bank again, which would be explosive. This all happened down there. Now, three people are on the board of this particular foundation. It's the Federal Election Commission. They changed it from the Presidential Transition Foundation to the Federal Election Commission, that investigated, and they said that they asked for a tax deduction, the commission, but they weren't listed for tax exemption that they wanted. The commission exposed this foundation of Ronald Reagan's, and while they wanted their tax deduction, as I say, it wasn't the kind of an institution that had even been approved. But the interesting thing is that three of the directors from this foundation that has this floating $977,000, one of them is Vern Orr, V-E-R-N-E-O-R-R is his last name. And Orr went on to have a very important job. He's our Air Force Secretary. The other director, along with Edwin Meese, who wants to be the Attorney General of the United States and wanted to get his military promotion simultaneously, the other director besides Edwin Meese and Orr is William Casey, who became director of the CIA. So here are private contributions. They are not listing the money. The article said that no one is allowed to audit, that they will let you know soon. There was no audit. They were not permitted to audit the records of the foundation. It's an entirely private foundation. The records haven't been disclosed. So, and the Federal Election Commission said that they wanted the names, addresses, and occupations of the donors and the size of the contributions. Well, here's a group getting Ronald Reagan into office who has the future head of the Air Force, the future director of the CIA, and the future attorney general would be, and they have up to $979,000 and $50,000 of that from a bank that they will not identify. So you can imagine where this one is going to go. It's a hot item, and it's from the New York Times on April the 16th. Another big article that I will not go into at length, but I just don't want you to think I passed it up. It's absolutely mind-boggling. Came out in the San Francisco Chronicle, the Washington Post, by Howard Kurtz. Kurtz is doing very good work on Edwin Meese. The title is The CIA at the Center of an Investor Lawsuit. Now, this has to do with a man named Ronald Rewald, R-E-W-A-L-D. He had a fake law degree from Marquette University written by the CIA. I haven't read that identified since John McCloy used Hans Tuft and wrote a fake law degree for him. And this Rewald went from Wisconsin, where he was under questionable circumstances of skirting around the law, but that didn't stop him. And the CIA sent him to Hawaii, where I want you to know where your tax money goes, because you're sending it in by midnight or already did it if you get this a week later. They bought $250,000 worth of cars, a fleet of cars, three Cadillacs, two Mercedes-Benz, a Rolls-Royce, a Jaguar, $60,000 for his boats, $82,000 for jewelry and art, $154,000 for travel, $102,000 on his relatives, $225,000 on household help, $541,000 on horses and polo expenses. That was just to get him settled in Hawaii, okay? He ran the Hawaii Polo Club and spent $250,000 a month. This is a CIA man with a fake law degree. Now, it was a CIA office for money to go to Taiwan, Philippines, and for rapid transportation in Japan. Remember last week's program, Mr. Sasakawa, with the rapid transit? He put $5 million to study the rapid transit between San Diego, again, where all this banking money and Edwin Meese and DeLorean and Pete Wilson, the whole gang come from, C. Arnold Smith. Mr. Sasakawa wants a rapid transit train from San Diego to Los Angeles. I was wondering, well, what is this 84-year-old man wanting that? But Sasakawa is involved with the World Anti-Communist League in the Philippines and in Taiwan, and so these CIA offices are there. Remember last week I suggested Sasakawa opening up, besides his mafia connections and his Mooney connections, helping get Reverend Moon started, how he opened up that New York office, the U.S.-Japan office for $47 million, and opened up the cherry trees in Central Park. He was there in 1979 to set up cherry trees on East 72nd Street. And John Lennon was shot on West 72nd Street a few months later. And here, see, I think of Mark David Chapman from Hawaii, who traveled around the world and had travel expenses with his Japanese-American wife, and right in the center of all this activity. Now, involved in this little scene in the paper from today's newspaper, April 16th, is General Arnold Braswell, B-R-A-S-S-W-E-L-L, former commander of the Pacific Air Force. That's a pretty big one to bite. You might, maybe I'm going too fast, you can send for sheets or write it down. General Arnold Braswell, former commander of the Pacific Air Force. General Hunter Harris, former vice president of the Strategic Air Command. This reminds me of 7 days in May. And one California businessman will have to look him up, because he's Mr. Robert O. Jinks. One of the cute things, when Mr. Rewald, you could call it Reward, went to Hawaii to set up his office, he set up a consulting firm under the title of Bishop, Baldwin, Dillingham, Rewald, and Wong. The only thing wrong with it is that Rewald and Wong are the only two people in the offices, and all the others are fake names. Bishop, Baldwin, and Dillingham don't even exist. They're not aliases. This was a two-man office plus security investments, and they're spending, as I say, $250 a month on his lifestyle and the cars and the household and the tutors and the horses and so forth and the Cadillacs, $250,000 for his fleet of cars. So those names don't exist. Now, we'll be doing a lot more on these people. I think, see, this opened up in 1977. That's just when the Nugenhan Bank was really flowing with the money for narcotics, for the CIA, for admirals, for generals, with William Casey, a CIA director who was in charge of the Phoenix program in Southeast Asia. These things will tie together. Those aren't small people, just like the Western Golds out of Virginia with the LA Police Department and their mutual computers. When you have Admiral Moore, the Joint Chief of Staff, you don't get any higher than that. So when you have the Pacific Air Command and you have Strategic Air Command, rather, and the Air Force, the head of the Pacific Air Force, you're dealing with some great big ones. So when the New York Times and the Washington Post just have two stories like that in one day, they may be competing for some Pulitzer Prizes, but they're sure pouring the stuff out, and just encourage them to keep going and read those papers, and we'll get back to those stories later. Now, earlier I got a call about the Reagan plan, his preemptive decision to set up a team for actually killing people ahead of time. What he wants is to make legal what we've been doing all along. He has what they call a still secret National Security Decision Directive 138, which Reagan signed on April the 3rd. Now, the allegation, the charge that he made was that because of the slaughter of 241 Marines in Beirut, Lebanon, last October, it's necessary to get offensive against terrorism. Now, we have killed all kinds of, not terrorists, Adlai Stevenson and Che Guevara was a terrorist, John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy. Someday, if we all live to see it, you will know that there were these death squads. And what Ronald Reagan wants to do, he was on the Rockefeller Committee to investigate the assassination plots against Castro and Patrice Lumumba and JFK and so forth. What he wants to do is to make it legal. So one of the things is to intensify intelligence collection at home by the FBI and the CIA and the Defense Intelligence Agency. Because those men were bombed in Beirut, we are going to get it at home. And as I said before, I felt that there were provocations. There were about four or five that came really fast. And I said that Ronald Reagan triggered them off for his own benefits. One was the Lebanon. First was Larry McDonald. One was the Lebanon. One was the bombing in Burma. And the other was the American embassy in Kuwait. Sure, they gave a few, they never found the people in Lebanon. They've got the best experts. Nobody, they can't account for it. The Burma thing involved people from the Burma government and was a provocateur thing. The Larry McDonald was set up. He was fingered by people in May for the links of Western goals to the LAPD and future operations. And he was sacrificed. And these people are going, these embassies like Kuwait and so forth, he will use. That is what Reagan was so good at when he was governor. He would use one thing to make an action which he planned long before. That's where Otto von Bolschwing and Helene von Dahm and the Gestapo that worked with Ronald Reagan were so useful. It worked in Germany, and it's working in America. So he has this, that what he's trying to do is make it legal and to proceed with this plan of preemptive raids against terrorists. Now, it cuts itself short of saying that we wouldn't kill somebody, but paramilitary teams could go in and do it. And it will give $500,000 for information on terrorism at home or abroad. The SLA is the CIA. Read that if you haven't. I wrote it in 1974. That was Reagan warming up for 1984. And if you haven't read it, I have copies and I can, you know, send them to you at cost. And if I run out, we'll reprint them. Another war story, the question of war looms behind the Nicaragua debate. Ronald Reagan is moving us towards war. That was in the newspaper yesterday, April 15th, 1984. Reagan says, we can't turn our backs. We can't turn our backs. They didn't want Somoza and Nicaragua. They didn't want the slave labor. They didn't want the exploitation. We did this for years, and now they are waking up any more than the Russians wanted the Tsar. They may not like what they got afterwards, but they didn't want that. So that this week he announces, because of Lebanon, and I accused him on this program, they had warning it was going to happen. I've cited this on World Watchers. Many times, each of these cases of incidences of provocateurs, they had warning about Beirut, but he needed that. So 200 died or 230. What difference does that make to Reagan? It's like at Berkeley where there's a confrontation of students and he says, if there's going to be a bloodbath, let it be. This man absolutely doesn't care, and I really believe he's mentally sick, but we're just as sick to have him as the president of the United States. So Reagan endorses his secret plan, his 138, whatever that is numerically. We'll have to look it up. I think it must have some secret directive, 138. We'll give it a thought. I'm sure there's some meaning. There's a double entendre in everything he does. Then the article of the question of war looms. And then I was watching Today Show this morning, Monday morning, and they had somebody talking about Central America. What are we going to do? And all of a sudden, the intelligent people come out and say, we have a problem. We better do something here. We're going to get in war. These people, it's not the Russians. There's poverty. All of a sudden, the deadbeat wake up, and they come up with solutions. Why didn't they come up with that 2 years ago or 3 years ago? There's been every instance of the Somoza people training in Florida, in Alabama, Texas, paramilitary, promised by the CIA they could come back and get their government back. Well, the time has come. You can't nurture things that make promises that long. And so this is going to be Reagan's chance to keep that promise for them or splinter this country apart. But they had an expert on NBC today, and he was saying, well, the subject came up, will we be at war in Central America? We will be at war, they said. Today, just casually, we will be at war. Will it be before or after the election? And that brings up the next question that I'll be going into from now on up through the Olympic Games, if we have the time and free air to do these things. What if there isn't an election, like Emperor Kissinger wants to be the head of this country? What if there isn't any election? What if the president owes too much to Kissinger and Kramer, any president, that they have to keep him around? So now I'm going to shift gears from the news that came out today and go to the question of what if there isn't an election, going into Edwin Meese, developing where the week before, in the last 4 or 5 weeks, Edwin Meese, Ursula Meese, the teams of the military, and how his links to these various elements are part of the news that's making news today. But just before I do that, I do have to cover one thing about the Nixon broadcast that were on CBS. I don't know how many of you saw them. And tonight, I'm not going to address myself to all the different subjects. I do want to talk soon at length about he blamed Watergate on Martha Mitchell because John was too busy taking care of his sick wife. He couldn't tend to business. And here we have Jeb Magruder and G. Gordon Liddy and all of them planning burglaries. He left Martha. She was in Washington. He was in Florida planning illegal burglaries with the CIA and the anti-Castro Cubans. But Nixon had to blame everybody. But the thing last night that was on the air was April 15th, 1984. And he was talking about John Kennedy and with his crony, Frank Gannon, G-A-N-N-O-N. And, of course, the questions he knew in advance, but the answers weren't fixed. And the question to him, Richard Nixon, when did you hear of the assassination of John Kennedy? When did you first learn or hear about Kennedy's death? He asked him. How did you hear of his death or the shooting? And Richard Nixon said, this is a direct quote, I was in a cab and a man ran over to this cab, evidently a signal or something, and said, did you know John Kennedy was shot? There was no radio in the cab, Nixon said. And it was 25 minutes before I got to my apartment, and then I called J. Edgar Hoover. Now, he didn't say that on this broadcast that he was in Dallas, Texas, the same day that Kennedy was shot. He didn't say that he was with J. Edgar Hoover at the home of Clint Murchison the night before Kennedy was shot. He didn't say he left Love Airfield a short while before Kennedy arrived. Isn't that a big coincidence that he ran against John Kennedy in 1960 and lost the election, and now his opponent of that 1960 election is killed in the same city where he is an hour after he's left town? One is going away, and one is going out of the way. And that's what happened. And he didn't mention on this broadcast that when he called J. Edgar Hoover, that how they were together the night before. What a coincidence, you know, it really was. And the first he said, I called Hoover. And I said to Hoover, this is Nixon, I said, who was it, a right-wing nut? Well, the nut is funny because he's a right-winger and Hoover's a right-winger, so why would it be a right-wing nut if they were accusing Kennedy of treason, the Birch Society that put Nixon into power? But that's the opening later for the General Walker story, and I won't go into that. But Hoover said, no, it was a communist. He calls it a communist. This is, if you can hear Nixon's voice, it was a communist. J. Edgar Hoover said, no, it was a communist. Now, that was 25 minutes after Nixon knew about this. Somebody had told him, and he called Hoover. Now, Kennedy was shot at 1:30 p.m., and Oswald was on a bus at 1:40 p.m., so 10 minutes had passed. And Oswald was in a taxi cab at 1:47, so 17 minutes is gone. And at 2 o'clock, when Kennedy was officially dead, it was announced he was officially dead, but the question he was asked was, did you know that John Kennedy was shot? The person who told him didn't have the report. He was that he had just been shot. Oswald left Mrs. Roberts' rooming house at 2:03, so 33 minutes are gone. Officer Tippett was murdered at 2:15. At 2:40, Lee Harvey Oswald ran into a theater. Now, in Death of a President by William Manchester, he has a chronology, but he doesn't have anything that happened from 2:40, which is an hour later, until the media, of course, announced at 4:20 that Kennedy was dead. But, of course, the FBI director would know. But isn't it strange that within 25 or 30 minutes, or give him 10 more minutes, that somebody had told Richard Nixon that Kennedy had been shot, and that when he calls the director of the FBI, he said it was a communist, and Lee Harvey Oswald wasn't even a suspect for hours in the John Kennedy assassination. He was picked up because somebody said he was seen running from the Tippett shooting, and he tried to go into a shoe store, and the shoe salesman said he went into a theater and followed him, and the theater called the police. So J. Edgar Hoover and Richard Nixon had the case solved within minutes, and it was hours, literally hours, before Lee Harvey Oswald was even hinted to be in the assassination, so a communist. So he really blew it, Richard Nixon. That was worth the money that CBS paid him to show that. I think he really blew that, because Penn Jones had written in Forgive My Grief, Volume 3, and you can get that series of books. They're marvelous. About the meeting at the home of Clint Murchison and Richard Nixon and J. Edgar Hoover. Interestingly enough, Penn compared it, when he wrote this book in 1969, to the most important decision since the invasion of Normandy, when Kennedy was shot and the takeover of America. Now, Ronald Reagan is going to France to celebrate the invasion of Normandy. It's 1983, and he's going over there to celebrate that particular, if you call it celebration, the anniversary of the Normandy invasion. Then he's coming back to Dallas for the Republican convention. So it's a full cycle. When Penn wrote that the death of Kennedy and the invasion of Normandy were the two most important events of American history in 1969, in 1984 we make a full circle. But Penn also wrote about the woman who was important to this assassination story, and this leads again to Edwin Meese and Ronald Reagan, because this story is not separated from Edwin Meese's hearings and Ronald Reagan, the President of the United States. The Murchison involvement, that's the famous oil man in Texas, of the assassination, may be the explanation for the hiding of Sylvia Odio, O-D-I-O, a young Cuban refugee, a very important witness, and right after the assassination, she was hidden in the home of Jack Rogers of Dallas, Texas, whose father, Ralph Rogers, is president of Texas Industries, one of the many firms controlled by the Murchisons. Now, Mrs. Odio was very important for a witness to the John Kennedy assassination, because William Seymour and Lauren Hall and the fellows from California that worked with the extreme right wing were at her home just a month before the assassination, saying that John Kennedy had to be killed. And William Seymour was impersonating, or allegedly was the man impersonating Lee Harvey Oswald, who visited her. Now, I have on broadcast 456, that was August 31st, 1980, I referred to the book by Bill Turner, Power on the Right, of Eugene Hall, one of the people involved in Dealey Plaza, and Sylvia Odio, with her. This is one of the contact of the Murchisons and Hoover, and Eugene Bradley, Edgar Eugene Bradley. Now, Edwin Meese was the legal advisor to Ronald Reagan when he was the governor of this state. and Edwin Meese refused to extradite Edgar Eugene Bradley to New Orleans, where Jim Garrison wanted to question him regarding the murder of John Kennedy. The Monterey Herald, June 27, 1968, Reagan aid studies extradition plea. Edwin Meese III, Reagan's legal advisor secretary, took under submission Wednesday the extradition of Edgar Eugene Bradley, whether he should go to New Orleans, where Jim Garrison wanted to question him about the murder of John Kennedy. Sheriff Craig, who was later murdered, said he saw Bradley on the steps of the Texas School Book Depository building, and Bradley worked directly with Ronald Reagan's team in California, which was Eugene Hall and Sylvia Odio's contacts out here in California. I talked about that in 1980. Now, in The Rebel, I referred to Richard Nixon and Herbert Hoover, and there's a picture of the two of them on page 27. That was the anniversary of Kennedy's death. The same Hoover and Nixon that Nixon was talking about this week on CBS, his buddy through it all, and he doesn't even blush to talk about it now. We'll take a 1-minute break and then